I'm not 100% sure this answers the question, because I'm not sure I really understand construct. But let me set up a slightly different one. Maybe this will help. Imagine you have a capacitor and a coil. You're hooking a capacitor up to a battery, and you make sure it is fully charged. You then disconnect it from the battery, and you connect the capacitor across the coil. This may sound familiar. It's an LC tank circuit. The energy stored in the electrostatic field in the capacitor will now start to transfer to building up a magnetic field around the inductor. And what will often happen is kind of like a pendulum. It'll swing back and forth at the resonant frequency of the combination, and the power goes from the capacitor into the, you know, electrostatic field capacitor to the magnetic field and inductor, and then back again. And they swing back and forth and generate AC at the resonant frequency. Does that help your understanding?
That makes 100%. I understand that now. Now that is complete. Now I know what it is. And this is KB2FYH. I thank you for your information.
Okay, congratulations, Ed. Keep in mind that since most of these things are not superconductors, eventually resistance does away with all the energy dissipating it as heat. But if you set up something like this with a superconductor, it could go on for a relatively long time.
Depending how it's stored.
But my point is, I thought that's where he was going. I couldn't be sure, but I figured it was worth a try. But that is the point. If the energy is bouncing back and forth between the electrostatic field and the magnetic field, and that's what makes an LC tank circuit resonant. I mean, you know, the resonance is exactly how it bounces back and forth. And yeah, eventually it will peter out. We all know that.
Yep, very good, Ed. I'm glad to hear FYH got his question answered. Another elucidation. Thank you, Ed. Thanks, everyone. Anyone with any comments before we move on to the SpaceNet report? Okay, very well. Thanks for everyone for participating tonight. I had a little presentation, but I don't know. Something's weird with the All-Star link, perhaps. I have to check into it. Anyway, thanks again. I'll be back later on, but now it's 10:15 and time for Paul WS2N and the SpaceNet report. Paul?
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Very good. Good topic tonight. And there's quite a bit of space news that's been going on in the last week. And just recently, yesterday, they launched the Dragon crew vehicle, Crew 7, they call it. The seventh dedicated flight for NASA to the International Space Station. And this one had a crew of four people on board. And the commander is Jasmine Warbell. She has a call letter, KI5WSI. And everything went well. It was delayed one day, but everything went fine. And today they docked up with the International Space Station. They went on to the space-facing port on the Harmony module. So that is two Dragon spacecraft attached to the Harmony module. There's other people already on board. They met up with seven other crew members that are already on the space station, and these four joined them. The other ones were Andreas Morgensen, also with a call letter, KG5GYZ, and then a fellow from Japan, Fukuoka, I think his last name is. Anyway, he's KE5DAW, along with a Russian. Now, Russian was his first flight up there. Japanese fellow, he's been up there before. And then Jasmine Morbell, she's actually from Long Island. Went to school in Baldwin and eventually worked her way up. Signed on with NASA in 2017, I read. And this is her first flight, but she was the commander of the four that went up there. They plan on staying for around 6 months, and that's the standard operating procedure when a new crew goes up there. There are some crews that have visited the space station and only stay for 10 days or so. One group stayed for around 17 days because they had some problems with weather, and they had to wait a while. But those were by Axiom, private company that contracts flights from SpaceX to fly in their Dragon to dock with the space station. NASA allows that now. And there's been two such flights, and there's more planned as well. Axiom 1, 2, and then the next one will be Axiom 3. But they're short stays. Like I said, 10 days is the average. But in this case, this is a regular NASA flight. They'll stay for the whole 6 months. And in time, the people on board will eventually return. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. And unfortunately, they're left in the middle of the night. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning or so when they did launch. So I got to see a replay, and that was about it. I try to watch these things live, but that wasn't going to happen last night. Another flight I was waiting for to take off from Japan is called the Chrism and Slim mission. I thought I was going to see this take off tonight just during the net. It was supposed to go off around 8:30 tonight from Japan, Tajima Space Center, where they launched their big rockets. They got an H2A rocket. That's their heavy lift vehicle. Liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen on both first stage and second stage. But the payloads were something called Chrism, and it's spelled not like it sounds. It's with an X, X-R-I-S-M, Chrism mission. And Slim is going to be a lander that will eventually try to land on the moon. And then Chrism is a space telescope that's being developed by JAXA, which is Japanese agency, NASA, and the European Space Agency collaborated on this thing. It's a space telescope that's going to receive X-rays and then transmit those pictures back down to Earth. It'll be in roughly a 300 to 400 mile high orbit. And the interesting thing about the X-rays is the high intensity light. That's all X-rays are. And when the when normal light comes down, you know, they can bounce it off a mirror and bounce it off a secondary mirror and a tertiary mirror and, you know, into a detector. You know, charge couples of a detector and then transmit the pictures back down to Earth. With the X-rays, they can't do that. The X-rays will actually pass right through a mirror, so you can't put up a parabolic mirror to do anything like that. So they use different kinds of mirrors. These are long tubes, you might say, long tubes, a couple of feet long. I think maybe 10 or 15 feet in this case. But these long tubes, but they gradually, you know, it gets smaller toward the end. And then they're aluminum, they're shiny, and X-rays hit them, and then they glance off the sides of the mirrors as they go down. And they have, in this case, I don't know, I read like there's a couple of thousand of these mirrors nestled into one another, you know, one surrounding the other. So you got to have all these photons glancing down these mirrors, and then they're directed to a detector at the bottom of the telescope, which is pretty interesting. It's really a follow-up from a 1999 launch when NASA launched the Chandra Space Telescope. Chandra has been very, very successful. Again, that has a series of tubes that go down. You know, they start off in a big diameter, and eventually they wind up in a small diameter near the detector. And that has been working since, you know, 2000, doing very well all these years, still operating. That is an interesting orbit. This one is going to be roughly 300 miles or so high. Chandra, what they do is it's in a highly elliptical orbit. It goes out to over 80,000 miles. That's roughly one-third the distance to the moon, and then comes back very relatively close to the Earth, around 1,000 miles near the Earth. But, it's highly elliptical. So when it's out there, you know, going like one-third distance to the moon, that area, that's when it's doing all its research, pointing at different stars, black holes. But when it comes near the Earth, then it starts transmitting back to the Deep Space Network. WS2N. So this is a similar type of deal, which I was wondering when they were going to eventually, you know, make another one of these X-ray exploring telescopes. I was wondering how long Chandra was going to last. You know, it was supposed to be like a five-year mission or something. You know, it was launched in 1999. So who knows how long CRISM is going to last. I hope it lasts a long time. Scientists will have a ball with the results coming back. I don't know the comparison between the two telescopes. I don't know how much more sensitive this one is going to be or anything like that. But we'll research that as time goes on. Anyway, inside the fairing is this telescope, but then there's another spacecraft on board called SLIM. SLIM stands for a smart lander for investigating the moon. And this is, again, primarily a Japanese mission, but NASA's involved with this as well. And maybe around 1,500 pounds. Not very, very heavy, but it's 6 feet high and I think around 4 feet or so in diameter. And once it lands, it's got like 5 legs on it. And then the idea is to land not near the South Pole. Everybody's shooting for the South Pole. Japan, in this case, wants to go more mid-range. They are going to try to land near one of these lava tubes. We've talked about lava tubes on the net before. The idea is that, you know, lava once it flowed on the moon, and then when it dried up, it left these massive lava tubes along the surface. You know, you probably put a small town inside of it. It would be a great place to do that, because it would be, especially on the ground, you'd be somewhat protected from radiation or micrometeorites. So, that's a long-term goal, but this one is supposed to actually land near that. So we'll see how SLIM does. It's going to take, I think, 4 or 5 months before it actually gets into orbit. You know, it goes into an elliptical orbit around the Earth, and then every time at perigee, it'll fire its thrusters, pushing in that apogee even higher and higher, until eventually it gets captured by the moon. And then from there, eventually, they'll try to land this thing. NASA's interested in it because there's technology on board to try to precisely land this vehicle within, I think, say, 100 meters, so, you know, like within the size of a football field. They want to be able to land this accurately. And this way, in the future, they'll be able to do that as well. So that's what's involved. If Japan makes it, they will be now the fifth country to successfully land something on the moon, following the United States, of course, and then Russia, China, and now just recently India, and then and Japan. So we'll see how they do. Any comments or questions for now before we go on? Okay, nothing heard last week, early last week anyway. After that, India, like I said, became the fourth country to actually land a vehicle on the moon. The Chandrayaan 3 lander successfully touched down. It was actually Wednesday. And it's their actually second try of actually landing on the moon. Back in 2019, which is, seems like yesterday to me, but it was you know, like 4 years ago, they tried to land Chandrayaan 2 on the moon, and things went wrong. I mean, they got very close, and the orbit was good and all, but some software issues, and eventually I believe it was wound up facing the wrong direction, firing its thrusters, and when I understand it hit the moon like 500 miles per hour, and that was all she wrote. But now this one, they tried again. They did say they were going to do it again. They have their own launch vehicle too, by the way, the geosynchronous launch vehicle, GSLV they call it. So it's a heavy launch vehicle that launches from India. And they did everything on their own, including the lander. Last one, Chandrayaan 2, they had two spacecraft panels and a lander, and they also had an orbiter. The orbiter was successful. That took pictures, you know, very active, very, very good on their orbiter, but their lander didn't make it. But Chandrayaan 3 sent pictures back. I've seen a couple of them already. And, you know, for a long time, India really wasn't heavily involved with the United States space program. But just recently, a couple months ago, they signed what's called the Artemis Accord. So they plan on working with NASA, supporting NASA's mission of Artemis to the moon. So there's quite a few countries, I think around 40 countries, that have already signed up for the Artemis Accord, and India is now one of them. They're coming along. They eventually will have a manned program. They try to do that this year, but it doesn't look like they'll probably make it until next year. Plan on launching a crew of three into orbit. And now that they're involved with NASA, I'm wondering if they'll probably... if they're going to have the adapter, the same NASA adapter that all the spacecraft now have. So there's a possibility that they may eventually be able to dock with the International Space Station. We'll see. Anyway, good for India. More the merrier, as far as I'm concerned. WS1. I'm leaving a pause. You never know if EchoLink is out there. I don't hear anything. Anyway, another spacecraft that tried to land on the moon recently was a company from Japan. So this, you know, the one that's going up now, SLIM, is actually a Japanese lander. There was one called Hakuto, which was made by iSpace. iSpace is a private company out of Japan. And they tried back in April to do the same thing. They tried to land on the south pole of the moon. But unfortunately, that mission failed. That would have been the first private company to successfully land on the moon. But it didn't work out. They had some problems with the spacecraft. They reoriented it from horizontal to vertical. and then it was supposed to be, apparently the computer on board thought it was, you know, pretty much on the surface, where it was still a couple of miles still up in the air. It was supposed to come down straight. Well, it did start coming down straight, but then because everything was off, they also ran out of fuel, and then they when that happened, you know, the computer showed that, you know, the spacecraft was coming down to the moon, and it was slowing down, but then the second they ran out of fuel, they sort of accelerate the 1/6 gravity of the moon, give it a accelerated path, and wound up crashing into the moon. But they didn't make it. But we'll see. There's a couple of other private companies that are on deck that are about to try to do the same thing. In this case, from the United States, there's Astrobiotic, and then another one called Nova C. We'll see how they do. I think they got a good shot. Any comments? Okay, nothing heard. Here's a story I heard earlier in the week as well. This one is about a couple of Japanese scientists back in 1983, that they decided to send a signal in the direction of a star. The star was called Altair. And their plan was to encrypt this measure, or not encrypt, but actually send a message. If you put the code of the message together, you wind up with pictures, you know, pictures of people. The idea was to try to communicate with another civilization. They thought of this back in the early 1980s, and they sure enough, they transmitted from California or something, these two fellows. So it was a great idea to see if you send a signal to a star that's within reason. This one's like 16 and a half light years away, that sooner or later they'll evaluate those signals. If there's an alien group on one of the planets around Altair, that they would decide to transmit a signal back to Earth. So last week they thought, well, this is going to be probably about the time that a signal would be coming back. If there was an intelligent species on one of the planets on Altair. So anyway, they actually waited for signals. They got a hold of a 200-foot dish somewhere. I think they're in Japan. I'm not sure where they were tracking this thing. But they had the thought, well, maybe the signal's going to come back. And they're probably still listening, you know. I mean, you know, it would take a while maybe for a civilization to figure out what kind of signal they received, and should they really turn around and send it back. I'm glad they didn't receive. If they're receiving any of the politics or anything that's going on here on Earth, chances of us hearing from them is probably going to be zero. Any comments? This is WS2N for the Space Night Report.
Paul?
I heard a station, but just it was maybe a millisecond of a transmission.
Okay, I'll try again, Paul.
Oh, okay, that was you, Roy. Very good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you ever have a chance, you might want to pick up the three-body problem. It's sort of the whole premise is that we sent a hello out there message that got picked up by aliens that warned us to don't do that ever again, and we did it again, and the rest of the book is taken up with the other group of intelligent life forms traveling towards Earth to invade us.
Very good. I can see that. You know, after reading this last week, actually the first time I heard it was actually on WOR radio. I was driving, and I said, oh, I got to look this up when I get home. And you have, it was another transmission that was used there and developed by Carl Sagan. He helped out designing a transmission, and they transmitted from the Arecibo radio dish, and I forgot where they aimed for. I was going to look that up. I never got around to it this week, but they did it once before, and a lot of people thought, man, maybe that's a bad idea. But it was soon after that, and it had to be again probably in 1990 or something like that, because around 1994, you know, after an anniversary of Columbus discovering America, the Congress cut any kind of funding for that type of purpose. They did not want any more transmissions going out of, I guess, the Arecibo telescope or anywhere else. They thought that might be a bad idea. You know, you have people in Congress that think the aliens are going to come here and eat us, I guess. I don't know what happened there. But they cut all funding. There was funding at one time for that. But they cut it back to your right.
Yeah, it's a very interesting book. It's kind of difficult to get into at the very beginning. It's written by a Chinese author, so there's a lot of cultural Chinese aspects at the beginning that kind of confused the heck out of me. But, I mean, they didn't come to eat us. They never actually got here. They got destroyed or detoured way before. I won't give it away. But at one point, their avatar shuttled the entire population of Earth onto the continent of Australia, and then they killed all the sources of food, and they said, well, if you people want to survive, I guess you're going to have to eat each other.
Okay, I'll definitely get it. This was called the three-body problem. That's the actual name of the book.
Yeah, that's the first volume. It's a three-volume series, and it took off so much in the world. I think they've made two television shows about it. They were talking about a movie, and a big fan actually went to the trouble of writing a fourth epilogue of what happened to the characters after the trilogy ended. But, you know, the trilogy is more than enough. You have to give it a little time to kind of work its way into your brain, though. It's not one of those things that you read the first 10 pages and you say, I have to finish this book.
I said, we'll do that. Because it's a confusing name if it's called Three Body Problem. Because there is an orbital let's call it orbital mechanics. You know, there is a three body problem with trying to establish an orbit between three objects, you know, when you have the sun, Earth, and a spacecraft, for instance. You have to, you know, you go through this mathematical nightmare of trying, you know, how much fuel you're going to need to keep that spacecraft at the L2 position properly, you know. But there's a whole thing with this whole three-body thing. You know, same thing with the Trojan asteroids, you know, in the orbit of going around the sun. That, you know, these asteroids are near Jupiter in the L4 and the L5 location. It's all part of this three-body problem. So it's a confusing name.
Well, it sort of makes sense as far as the novel goes, because the aliens that are going to come and kill us and take over our planet are living in Alpha Centauri, which is a binary star system. So two stars, one planet, three-body problem. And they live in a chaotic solar system. So they much prefer our less chaotic solar system. So that's where the three-body problem gets its name.
Oh, very good. Okay, now that even sounds better. It's named after a real possibility. That's very well done. Yeah, you got Alpha Centauri and Proxima Centauri. I guess they're using those two stars with the planet. They have made discoveries where there are planets now that actually orbit two suns, two stars. Read that not too long ago, actually probably about 5 years ago, which at one time they thought that would be impossible.
Yeah, you sort of think that it's rather chaotic. I mean, the three-body problem is not a solvable equation unless there's special cases, and that's the case with the NASA. If one of the three bodies is relatively much lower mass than the other two, you can actually solve the problem. But if they're anywhere close to each other, it's an unsolvable equation.
Yeah, if it's heavier, it's easier. I'm sure somewhere where they said it's similar to the idea of you could take a yardstick and balance it on your finger, no problem. But if you take a pencil and try to balance it on your finger, you have a problem. It's not that easy. Something similar to that effect. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting equation. People use it to demonstrate the principles all the time. And a lot of times there are insolvable, presently, things that have special cases. And if you find the special cases, then hooray for you. Stephen Hawking needed to have a theory of quantum gravity to explain Hawking radiation, which doesn't exist. But he found a very special case of quantum gravity that was relatively easier to explain, although he didn't do it in his book. He basically made up a fib of explaining Hawking radiation in his book because he thought the real reason was too confusing for people. But that's a special case phenomena as well. There are a lot of very, very complex, very difficult / impossible equations to solve. But in particular conditions where one is massive, the other one smaller, the distances are near infinite, they become special cases, and you can actually solve them and collect an award.
Hawking's radiation. Wasn't that where, I might be confusing this with another topic, but wasn't that where particles got near the black hole? And then they separated, and then one became a virtual particle or something, where one would actually go into the black hole, but the other part escaped and went out to space. Was that, that might be another topic, but was that Hawking's radiation, what he considered Hawking's radiation?
Yes, AC2GS, by the way. That is his make-believe answer that's in all the books that he received millions and millions of dollars for, and it's complete and utter nonsense. The idea was that in the vacuum of space, virtual objects go in and out of existence. And when they happen to come into existence close towards, very near the event horizon, one of the two virtual, now real particles gets sucked into the black hole, and the other one gets ejected away from the black hole, and the thing that gets ejected is the radiation, the Hawking radiation, and the object that falls into the black hole decreases the total mass of the black hole, so you don't have, you have a consistent mass equation. Mass can neither be created nor destroyed. The only problem is that there's no virtual particle that, when it falls into a black hole, decreases the mass. Matter, antimatter, they all have positive mass. So if that was the reason, then it would increase the weight of the black hole, and you would have violation of conservation of energy. So most physicists laughed when they read that, but it sells books.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Now you know where I got that idea from one of Hawkins' books. Okay. Understood. Yeah, he had some good, fun books to read, but I didn't really take them too seriously. I mean, they were okay. You know, well, I had nothing else to read. Carl Sagan was dead, so I must have almost every book he wrote. But you're not gonna have another Sagan, that's for sure. Back to you.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson tries, and he does reasonably well. Sometimes he veers off into futurists and popularist kind of things as well as the good old Michio. Those days are gone, unfortunately. I recently saw him on a YouTube replaying his talk to the Congress about global warming back in the 80s, and it was a masterpiece to watch.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah. He was the first guy, I believe, to come up with or popularize the idea of the nuclear winter. What would happen, you know, if we nuke the heck out of the planet, and you know, even if you survive, now you're not going to make it for the next, you know, 5 to 10 years because of nuclear winter. He was the first one to scare the wits out of everybody, which was probably a good thing.
Yeah, I think we need to be scared more because we don't take things as seriously as they should, and we take nonsense very seriously. It's very strange. The only problem I ever had with Carl Sagan, I admired him a great deal. He's a Bensonhurst boy. He don't sound like anyone I know who got brought up in Bensonhurst. It took me years to figure out what was going on. Then I saw an old video of one of his first interviews with Walter Cronkite when he sounded much more Bensonhurst. So I've come to the personal conclusion that he basically grafted a less hoarse version of Walter Cronkite onto his method of speaking.
It's doable. Take people from the Midwest or whatever, they want to become actors here, and they want to play somebody, you know, a New York detective or something. They could change their accent. Never 100%, you know, you can always tell. But I guess Sagan did the same thing in reverse. Yeah. I grew up in Brooklyn. But a shame when we lost him. He died from some kind of rare disease. Something got into his brain or something. They said it was very rare. And that's what got him. But I thought he was going to be around forever, that guy.
I thought he died of a lymphoma or such. I don't recall exactly. I remember how bad he looked towards the end. Everyone looks bad towards the end. Richard Feynman, God bless him. The man had a Far Rockaway accent to the day of his death. I mean, you could pretty much pin down exactly where he was brought up.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Yeah, good physicist. All right. Very good, Roy. I pretty much ran out of topic. So I did want to talk quick about the Parker solar probe that just made another pass past Venus. I know Dick used to love the topic of, you know, when that thing was going to launch and all. Parker probe is the one that it's been out there about 5 or 6 years now. And it's getting closer and closer to the sun every time it orbits the sun. The final goal is to get it within 4 million miles of the surface, but and it's getting there. Every time it passes Venus, it uses the gravitational assist not to accelerate the speed, but to decelerate the orbital speed around the sun. And by doing that, when it does pass the sun, it actually, you know, I mean, its relative speed to the sun is actually increased. It's up to 400,000 miles per hour, so it's really moving, and still doing science when it does that. But now they think that it's between this one and the European solar probe, they call it European, the European Space Agency has one as well. And that one's trying to shoot for a polar orbit of the sun. But a lot of information is coming back from the two of them. Now they found out that there's some kind of solar event a jet that's pushing out of the sun, and now they think that that's the origination of the solar wind. So, I don't know, I'm going to research that some more. That came out last week as well. But in other words, between these solar probes, and, you know, what we got going around the sun, they think they might have a good idea in the near future of what actually causes the solar wind, which goes out in all directions from the sun, which also creates our auroras. Auroras on Jupiter and all. I thought that was pretty interesting. WS2M. Okay. And then Rocket Lab is constantly launching rockets. I think they're up to their, coming out close to their 50th launch. Rocket Lab launches out of the North Island and New Zealand. And they have two launch pads there, and they have another launch pad in Virginia, in the States, in Wallops Island, and launch out of there as well. But recent launches, they've been saying for a long time they would like to eventually have reusability, but with the 9 engines on the bottom of the booster, but they wanted to start with one, and they thought, oh, maybe next year or the year after they'll be able to get that far. They accelerated that program. They've already just launched. They've just launched a booster with an already used rocket engine from a previous launch. So they're well on their way. They'll probably do 2 or 3 more next time. And eventually, all 9 will be reused. So to keep the launch cost down. I mean, they can launch for like $15 million. Which is a big difference from SpaceX. SpaceX is around $62 million, they said, for a Falcon 9 rocket. All right, it's a gigantic difference. SpaceX is launching maybe 1,000-pound payloads at the most, where SpaceX could, do probably up to 30,000 if they wanted to, especially if they use their extra heavy vehicle. But same token, if you're somebody wants to launch a satellite into space, like within a couple of months, you could sign up with Rocket Lab, and they'll put it in any trajectory you want. You don't have to wait for a ride share with SpaceX, so there's certain advantages for working with them, and they have a big manifest in front of them, ready to go. They've launched. I think this year they'll probably be able to launch around 20 or so. And I think they're up to one a month. So they'll probably get to around 15 launches maybe this year. So they're doing pretty good. Any comments? Okay, nothing hard. We're getting up to the top of the hour. So, Roy, I'm going to pass back to you. Great night tonight. And thanks for everybody that listened, participated, and we'll be back next week. And Roy, there was a Newham that checked in in the chat room.
Complete.
So hopefully we'll get to hear him, Mike. Good to see somebody new check into the chat room. I hope on this net. I don't know if he's been on the repeater or not, but on this net. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
AC2GS, thank you, Paul. Thank you for all that you do for us. I saw Mike's comments in the chat room. I hope he comes back. I hope he becomes an active member. He's a new technician. So when I was a technician, I was only a technician for about 10 minutes, though. I had a lot of questions, so I hope he comes back and asks a whole bunch of questions. So thank you Thank you, Paul. Thanks to everyone who participated, especially at WB2EAZ. I really appreciate your participation, as I do every single other person on the technical net. You guys make or break the technical net. I hope you consider that this was a good one, and we'll try again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. to do it all over again. Rebels now are done, and as Dick used to end his technical net, he always urged people to be kind to each other, especially these days. Please try. We need each other. I always like to quote Epictetus, a Roman philosopher. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas. Learn new things. It's fun, and it keeps your brain a little bit young. So everyone have a great week. Enjoy yourself. Please try as best you can to join me here next Sunday night when we do this all over again. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. And as always, Slava Ukraine.
Yep, yeah, call if you're still there, WB2BXL.
Hi, Frank, WB2BXL, WS2N.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I had told Roy earlier in the week that I didn't know if I would be able to get on a little bit because I'm out on the West Coast visiting my brother's family. Anyway, so it's still nice and early here. I realize it's obviously 3 hours later there. In any case, I remember reading about the experiment, I think, that was done from Arecibo, where did the transmission to some very distant, some star cluster, 200,000 or some ridiculous number of thousands of light years away, which will always seem ridiculous to me. And the other ridiculous part of the experiment was the beam heading, the beam was directed at where the star cluster was at the time of transmission, not where the star cluster would be at the time the signal got there. So the whole thing, though I understand from talking to people who spoke to people at Capitol Hill about it, that it wasn't the reason the Hill brought the hammer down on the project. The project did not make very much sense scientifically. The reason given by the Hill staff for bringing the hammer down on the project was, quote, high giggle factor, unquote, for whatever it's worth. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, they didn't want to pay for us searching for little green men. But, okay, yeah, star cluster, that's what it was. I forgot about that. Yeah, thousands of years away. So, yeah, come back 4,000 years from now, we'll get an answer. But actually, a cluster is good because you got a good chance of, you know, maybe one of them being occupied, you know. So, you know, if you stick around for a couple of thousand years, we'll get a reply. Where the other one going to Altair, you know, you're rolling the dice on one particular star, you know. And if you read the article, well, I just read the article last week about this, the one that they sent to Altair, and they said the two Japanese scientists were drunk. They were carried away, and they come up with this, and that's what they did. Who knows if that story is true, but, you know, oh, let's try this. Okay. But, they're always interesting stories. I think we still have a better chance of, you know, what they have been doing, setting up antennas all around the globe and constantly monitoring the sky, especially in the, they call it the hydrogen area, with, 4 gigahertz. So, you know, 4.136, I think, gigahertz. And hopefully you're hearing something there. I think they got a better shot at that than trying to transmit and hope something comes back, Frank.
I think I read that the hydrogen line frequency is supposed to be protected so that astronomers can listen on it? Or is there a lot of garbage on there now from satellites and Wi-Fi and stuff like that? Go ahead.
I'm going back 5 or 10 years at least. And, you know, back then I remember hearing that it was protected, you know. But who knows? I haven't read that there's been a problem with that frequency. Because I haven't read it, my guess is that there probably is not a problem. I think that would be a big deal if it was.
Yeah, I remember the same thing. As I said, I vaguely remember reading that the frequency was protected by the various treaties so that radio astronomers could monitor it. But, yeah, I mean, I see why. I think the Arecibo experiment may have had some merit, but at the same time, for it to work, the signal would have had to be aimed at where the star cluster will be at the time of arrival, leading the target, as I think they say in ballistics. Go ahead.
Okay, but a massive star cluster, they think it's going to move that far? A certain amount of degrees off target in a couple of thousand years. And, you know, they all move, you know. But a couple of thousand years doesn't sound like it would move that far, does it?
Well, I don't know the math. I do know, I remember there were, like, some pinholes into the pyramids, shafts in the pyramids that don't point at anything now, but did point that important stars, at least in the ancients' view, several thousand years ago. So I guess it depends on the parallax at that distance. And as I said, I don't know the demand, so I don't know if this is really an issue or not. But that's what I read somewhere, the issue with that experiment. So go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. If they went through all that trouble, they should have been able to predict where it was going to be. Well, I guess they didn't think of it. What, they come up with this a year later or 10 years later? Well, you don't know, Frank.
I really don't know. I mean, I would think in the grant review process, one of the referees would have, or reviewers would have said, hey, wait a minute, you have to lead the target and aim it where it will be. So I don't really know what the history of that and why nobody thought to ask the principal investigator to make the correction, if indeed the story is accurate, and it sounds to me like it might well be. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, everything moves up there. I think they said Vega at one time was the North Star, going back, who knows, how many eons sign, you know, North Star, you know, you come back, you know, 100,000 years from now, that's going to be in a different location. Well, okay, Frank, I'm gonna turn in. I want to lose my voice. I don't know how that happens. You know, 45 minutes is nothing on ham radio. Thank God for CW. I never lose my voice on CW, Frank. Back to you.
I understand that, Paul. I mean, you can get carpal tunnel, but you won't lose your voice. But actually, that was a problem, I guess, with hand keys. I don't know if that's an issue anymore. I haven't with the modern keyers, and of course, the most serious CW. I would say, I don't know, I'll get a lot of, I'm sure people with CW Club would laugh at me. I said serious CW operators use your keyboards because many of the serious CW operators don't. I don't actually like using the keyboard. I use one only out of necessity when I operate the remote sites on the computer just because it's the only practical way to do it without some fancy interfaces. Anyway, firstly, like I said, I'm out on the West Coast this evening, where it's only a little after 8 in the evening, but I know it's later there, and everyone has to get up on Monday morning. 73, WB2BX up.
Thank you for recommending
What city did you say, Frank? Yeah, I'm in Sacramento, where this is visiting. I was visiting with my oldest brother's family, and somebody else jumped in there. I'm not sure who it was.
Okay, very good. Hope you have a nice time out there. 73, Frank. The other station, he says it was a station. Go ahead. This is Paul, WS21.
Paul, this is AS. I wanted to thank you for recommending the book, The Astronomers, a couple of weeks back.
Yeah, isn't that a good book? I mean, they take you through one step after the other, all the way up the line, you know? They focus on each person, what they did, how they got from, you know, step one to step two, and then the next guy, and then all the way up the line. Did you get through the whole book?
Yes, sir. I enjoyed it. And the only problem with the book is me hungry for more.
You broke up at the end. The only problem with the book was question mark.
It leaves you hungry for more.
Yeah, I agree. That's true. You know, it's not already an older book. We need a Astronomers Part 2, you know. From where they left off, that's what we definitely need that. Yeah, I have that book. Did you get it out of the library? I own that one.
No, I bought it. I heard you recommend it a couple of weeks back. I can't remember exactly when it was. And right away I bought it because I knew, you ignite the hunger in me. I like to listen to your reports when I get the chance. So thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Very good. And I forgot your call, though. Again, this is WS21.
No problem. The call is AF2P, like Air Force 2 plane.
Oh, okay, AF2P. Very good. Very good. Very good. Thanks for letting me know that. You know, I've actually read it a couple of times because, you know, it's an older book now, and I remember reviewing it another time. But it becomes a good reference book, you know, as the time goes on, somebody says something, you go, oh, I know, I'll find that. You know, that thing about Hubble and the red ship and all, or, you know. Very good. Very well done. All right, good. We'll say 73 to you. AF2P, this is WS2N. I'm going to sign clear.
73, Paul, and thanks again. AF2P clear.
Yes, Paul. One more quick question. Does it still look likely that SpaceX is going to try a Super Heavy Starship launch this week, or have they scrubbed that because of pad damage from the static fire? Have you heard that anything one way or other? WB2BX?
Yep, what is that? Yesterday or the day before, they lit it off again for 5 seconds. And they got the whole 5 seconds out of it. And they had all 33 engines fire. Two of the engines shut off a second or so early. I don't know if that's going to affect anything. You know, maybe they'll be able to do it. We'll see. That's the last I read. I haven't gotten an idea of when they're going to be allowed to do it. They have to clear with the FAA. They have to approve the
flight. I don't think they've gotten the approval yet, but I think their water deluge system is doing okay.